Hello, this is Dan Young with Common Ground Media and the Noyo Radio Project. I'm here on location in New Orleans in the Lower Ninth Ward, just a few hundred feet from where the levee broke. And I'm here with Francesco De Sentis, who's going to talk about a book and a project that he's been involved with here, or started here.
So my name is Francesco De Sentis. I'm the founder of the Portrait Story Project in New Orleans after Katrina. Its form was the post-Katrina Portrait Project. And I arrived at Common Ground on September 11th, 2005, less than 2 weeks after Katrina, when Common Ground was about 6 days old. And before I even knew it was an organization, per se, that had a name, I was already volunteering for it. My friends Scott Crow and Brandon Darby had come down as rescuers, bringing solidarity to their friend, former Black Panther Malik Rahim. And that story is pretty well described by Brandon and Scott Crow elsewhere, so I'm not going to go into it. But Brandon gave a 6.5-hour monologue, which became part of the post-Katrina portraits, written and narrated by hundreds. I drew him 14 or 15 times, and in Brandon's case, it was an oral presentation. Most of those that I drew 2,000 people over the course of 13 months. They were Katrina and Rita survivors, those that stayed the entire time, residents that evacuated and returned, volunteers that came from all over the world, long-term and short-term volunteers, and people that came here in search of livelihood, including undocumented workers, overwhelmingly from throughout Latin America. So I would draw the protagonist, the subject of the portrait, the person whose individual life was intersecting with the historic moment of the post-Katrina scene in North America's Gulf region. And then they would consolidate their memories into an anecdote or a story, and then commit it to paper. And that's basically all history is. It's memory committed to archival form. They would write it right on the portrait. And then every post-Katrina portrait was an independently standing installment. There were some cases where the people that I drew opted to be tape-recorded and then have their words transcribed. There's a lot of illiteracy throughout North America's Gulf region, and you also had elderly folks with arthritis or conditions like that, or there were some folks that were just more oral as personalities and just responded more voluptuously, you might say, to just being able to relate their story out loud, and there was a certain kind of tone that flowed from that that wouldn't emerge as easily in a written format. So there was some value to that, although the labor for recording it and then transcribing it was pretty immense and eventually found to be unsustainable. So I won't be offering that option for the next Portrait Story project. Folks will have to write directly on the page. And it's more authentic that way, too, because their handwriting is a part of their voice. It's their mood. It's their temperament. It's a part of who they are, essentially. And that's what the Portrait Story Project is trying to convey, as direct from the source as you can get, history as told by the people that were the material of history, are the subjects of history. Inviting those that are those that become history to write the history themselves, because history is a social construct, and so knowing that, the philosophy is to construct it intentionally, to assert it rather than just leave it up to future generations to interpret, to state our own voice so that there's less to be manipulated when more is left unsaid.
Wow, that's really wonderful. Can you, I'm really curious how you got the inspiration to do this particular project.
Well, I came down first as just a disaster relief worker. I draw people wherever I go, and once in a while, it accumulates and crystallizes into such a coherent creative regime that unfolds into a large project. You can see them all on a postkatrinaportraits.org or portraitstoryproject.org. You can also see them on the Hurricane Digital Memory Bank's website. They hung on the walls of Common Ground spaces for a while. The originals did, and then later prints of them did. And anybody is welcome to reproduce the drawings and hand them out or keep them for themselves, and trying to make the material as accessible as possible to those that I drew. It was their goal to expose their perspectives, to make that accessible. So there's no royalties have to be paid for printing it off the website, and it's just encouraged to get it out there.
Yeah, so how long were you working on this, and how many portraits did you do?
2,000 portraits I drew over the course of 13 months between September of 2005 and October of 2006, and I picked the most legible and anecdotal, approximately 400, to go into chronological order and to be put into the post-Katrina portraits, written and narrated by hundreds, the entire contents of which can be seen on the website I mentioned. And I gave a Common Ground Collective and Common Ground Health Clinic publishing permission, as did those that I drew, hoping that they would publish it and then use it as a fundraiser for their continued work in healing and rebuilding, restoring the Gulf, being an apparatus for residents to empower themselves. And when Common Ground was unable to do that, I self-published and then offered to let them have it at printing cost. Just doing everything I could to continue entrenching the hardcover into the communities that gave birth to it, because that's where the book belongs.
Wonderful. So when you were approached people about drawing their portraits and getting their stories, were most people receptive to that?
Yeah, well, New Orleans is a collection of neighborhoods, and I think word got around really fast. Extended families, church groups, just, you know, neighborhood gossip. Residents coming in, returned evacuees or survivors that stayed the whole time, they'd come into the distribution centers or the volunteer centers, and they'd see the drawings up on the walls. And the gist of the project was very intuitive, and there was just this kind of immediate synergetic understanding of what the purpose of it was. Even folks that were almost illiterate would just take a glance. Oh, that's somebody's face, and that's their story, and it's about this right here, right now, because there was a need for it. And there was a unique historical moment where that became a really obvious need. And so when people seized that chance, there was the cultural incentive to preserve memory, particularly in that space and time. And so a lot of people were into it right away. Those born and raised here can trace their ancestry back generations. Those that have lived here, those that were coming to help but had never been in the city before, even those that came here just in search of livelihood. It was pretty well understood. You know, in a lot of the neighborhoods in New Orleans, the porch is of architectural prominence. Folks will hang out on their porch and socialize there. It's where family life is, neighborhood life is. And folks would wave to me from their porches, and I'd ride up and introduce the project. I'd have the sketchbooks and pencils in my backpack. I'd be on a bike or I'd be on foot. And I draw one member of a family who would then peer pressure other members of the family to sit for it too, and just kind of a domino effect. Or I'd sketch a reverend of a church, and then he'd want some of his service goers to be drawn as well. So that part was fun. Sometimes I drew a lot of volunteers as well. During the height of volunteer influxes, I would have volunteers sitting in line and working on their rough drafts, and people would sit in line up to 6 hours. And the portrait took as little as 15 minutes, but usually over a half an hour and as much as 1 hour, depending on the lighting and the position and how well the person sat. You know, very few of those that I drew just happened to be professional models, so I I had to have a faster hand than what's perhaps usual in the fine art world of formal portraiture, people would recognize their likenesses and their own expressions, and that was what was significant.
I was wondering, are there any particular stories you'd like to share with us now, either about any more that happened in the course of doing the portrait project, or stories that you gathered from people that really stuck in your mind that you'd want to share with listeners?
Well, the fact that there's a mainstream notion that I've seen throughout a lot of corporate media, and even a lot of media that thinks of itself as independent, that and it's just a general sentiment I've encountered in so many people outside the Gulf region, that the government wasn't there for the people of New Orleans at all, and that there's only a really thin grain of truth to that statement, I think, because the government was in New Orleans after Katrina. It was here as mandatory evacuation. It was here as a military occupier. It was here as institutions enforcing a new Trail of Tears and a Mid-Atlantic Passage for the 21st century. It was forcing residents to leave neighborhoods at gunpoint and separating parents from kids, or trying to, and not informing people where they were being evacuated to, and then setting up military checkpoints to prevent people from returning, to prevent people from being able to find out about the conditions of their homes. And then New Orleans Parish and wanted to bulldoze neighborhoods, wanted to hire private bulldozers to raise neighborhoods to the ground, confiscate the land titles, and then auction it off, exercise eminent domain, and then sell it to larger capitalists, outside investors, to just... It was neo-imperialism. It was domestic colonization. This was as much as gentrification ever escalates. This was the first escalation of gentrification would just be bureaucracy, rising taxes, market forces. The escalation after that would be police brutality and the prison industrial complex. This was the United States military invading a city within its own borders for its domestic ruling class and for, you know, the aristocrats uptown. This is, you know, what some New Orleanians would call the plantation mentality going on. It was what some in the South would call carpetbagging. This was predatory capitalism, disaster capitalism, disaster profiteering. This was vulture capitalism. This was using public health and even environmentalism, public safety, as a pretense to dispossess people. A lot of New Orleans residents have chosen not to move back. If they've owned the land, they've often chosen to sell the land, and that's their choice. That's their personal or individual or family self-determination. And I respect and honor that, and I think Common Ground Volunteers as a whole do and did. But what was a fundamental issue was whether or not they had the right to choose. And the right to choose whether or not to sell the land was being taken away from them. You shouldn't be able to buy something if it's not for sale. But the government had it for sale, but the government had not bought it. It was just, it just seized it.
That was a wonderful overall articulation of the situation. I guess that was going to be my next question, was what the larger patterns you observed to this project was. But
Grassroots mobilization, the People's Hurricane Relief folks and a few Common Ground volunteers and residents. We stood in front of bulldozers. We prevented eminent domain from being exercised. We got the government to drop its stance, to suspend its military curfew. There's not many anti-gentrification struggles where you can just say outright, we upped the ante, we told them, fuck you, and we won, and the government just ran away with its tail between its legs and gave up its stance because things were coming to a head so quickly that it had to end one way or another. You know, normally gentrification is an agonizing, sometimes decades-long process of an original population being slowly disempowered and ground out and disenfranchised. This was happening immediately, but that also created the potential for the aggressor to be stopped in their tracks immediately. It created the potential for a movement to consolidate all its force to get in the way and call the bluff, which is what we did.
Wow, that's amazing. Very inspirational victory. So my next question was going to be, basically this series of interviews that this is part of, kind of the overall theme is the idea of rebuilding a more just and sustainable New Orleans. Do you have any ideas or thoughts about, which is a slogan that's on the common, some of the Common Ground literature, do you have any ideas or thoughts about that?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, there's a lot of community gardens throughout New Orleans, and I find that very inspiring. There is some local economy that comes out of that urban beautification, and it's not up to me because I'm not settling here. I don't live here. I wasn't born and raised here. But just if you're asking about things that occur to me that I think would be cool to do if I was, there's a lot of homes have proven structurally unsound, and the homeowners or the landlords eventually made the decision to bulldoze them. So there's a lot of space that's opened up in the city. There's a lot more open land, and I think it'd be cool for neighborhood organizations or household members to turn them into more community gardens, to bioremediate the soil, to make the soil safe to cultivate from and for children to play in, and to create some self-sufficiency that way, just to be less dependent on and then therefore less vulnerable to the fluctuations of the job market and less dependent on government handouts. I'd say, you know, when buildings are being rebuilt, you know, build them higher. I see that happening. I think perhaps one of the most important things, the wetlands need to come back. I know a lot of volunteers have planted native grasses in the wetlands, because the wetlands are the horizontal levee, the first line of defense against the hurricanes. The wetlands absorb so much of the hurricane's power so that by the time it gets far enough inland to reach the city is safer because the hurricane's lost its vitality. Well, New Orleans has been made as vulnerable as it is because of continental erosion, because of the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet and other canals that have been cut through the marshes for the oil industry have brought salt water upstream, so to speak, and then the root systems of the plants can't handle the salinity, so they die and they let go of the soil, and it just turns into the Gulf of Mexico. Now, you know, continental erosion is natural, but it's happening at an unnaturally accelerated rate. And then also, the wetlands aren't being replenished as fast because so much of the Mississippi River is levied, so it's not going through its annual flood, and it's not then enacting its natural hydrology to send soil downstream to then deposit and you know, on the continental shelf is this rich soil. And I think it's ironic in a way that a lot of the levees along the Mississippi were built to protect farmers from annual flooding, but it's precisely that flooding that made so much of the Louisiana-Mississippi Delta so fertile in the first place. So I think that the civilization as a whole, historically, that's come to dominate what Eurocentrics call the New World, just has not had an appreciation of the rhythms of the land itself. And that short-sightedness has caught up with us. And that's besides the whole global warming issue and besides the specific pollution that's in the Gulf of Mexico because of industries that have risen its temperature to make hurricanes more frequent and then nastier when they do happen. I've heard that 2005 was the worst hurricane season in recorded history. It's the first time that the names of hurricanes went into the Greek alphabet. You know, they're named by letters, and then when they get to Y or W, then they skip over X and Z, I believe, and then go to Alpha, Beta, and Zeta. So you're looking at New Orleans has always had hurricane season, and for a lot of New Orleanians, their frame of reference wouldn't be an overall analysis of global warming per se, but a Hurricane Betsy in 1965 or the Great Flood of the Mississippi in 1927. You know, these disasters are not new per se to New Orleans, but they're potentially getting more serious. Yeah.
Thank you. I wanted to change the focus just a little bit, if you were willing. I wanted to, while I have you here, I always find it really inspiring to find out why people became interested in their lives in radical social change and things like that. And I wanted to see if you'd be willing to share anything about your own life, personal transformative experiences that took you in this direction.
I think if you ignore somebody else's need for their freedom and self-determination when that need is becoming obvious and concentrated, then you're also ultimately making yourself more vulnerable too. Sometimes I'd be asked what the meaning of solidarity, not charity, meant. And for me, charity is something that you do because it makes you feel good to do it, and you don't perceive it as having any direct consequence for you. You're doing it to ease your conscience or out of pity or, you know, feeling bad for somebody else. When it's solidarity, you might just claim it's just a psychological distinction in some cases. It's because you perceive it as also ultimately, even if it's in a very roundabout or indirect way, being one and the same with your own struggle or desire for freedom and self-determination to achieve it or retain that which you already have. And it takes vigilant maintenance to do that. I just met somebody that was from the Woodlands Apartments today, and he was talking about how volunteers assembled in front of the Algiers courthouse and applied the pressure so that he could stay there from Thanksgiving until Christmas. They postponed the evictions so that tenants could be home for the holidays with their families so that they'd have more time to find another place to live. And he said, I'd never seen strangers come out of the blue and just help before. And I was like, that's called solidarity. That's what that is.
Actually, could you give just a bit of background for listeners that aren't familiar with the Woodlands Apartments?
Oh boy, probably another Common Ground volunteer would be better qualified to do that. Okay. There were different phases that were envisioned in Common Ground's political trajectory. There was the immediate disaster relief and rescue, and then eventually there was the rebuilding phase and creating a local economy. The Woodlands Apartments, I believe it was 13 acres, if I'm not mistaken, and hundreds of units. And we were bioremediating it, cleaning it out, making it habitable. There was black mold in it. There was excessive moisture. There were weeds growing up from the carpet. It was broken glass, and it was just one of the worst scenes in New Orleans. There were small children playing around corpses, poking it with sticks because it was just, it had gotten that deprived. And it was racked with gang warfare and hard drugs, and then, you know, the gang warfare coming out of a competition as to whose territory it was to sell what hard drugs. And the murder rate was very high there. And Common Ground got management rights to it and began cleaning it up to with the long-term goal of it becoming a housing cooperative. And for the first floors of some of the apartment buildings to become spaces reserved for tenants to have their own local small businesses, and for the tenants to become their own landlords to hire themselves for the maintenance of the place. And so this dream was underway and becoming popular among the new tenants and the old tenants that were there until the land was yanked out from underneath Common Ground by the landlords that were accepting a higher bid for it. So probably, yeah, I'm sure you'll find somebody that has...
And so that was what led to the tenants, the tenants that you mentioned being evicted and getting more time, they were being evicted after the landlords had taken the higher offer.
Right, that's it. They were going to be evicted, I believe, by Thanksgiving, and there was a volunteer rally and in front of the Algiers courthouse, and the eviction got postponed till Christmas. Yeah.
So, building on that last question, the question before the Woodlands, actually, about how you became involved in radical social change, I guess I'm curious how if you had anything interesting to tell about how you started combining your art with your interest in radical social change initially. Before the Portraits Project.
That might be a little too loaded. Yeah, I'm not quite ready to go there yet.
Okay, no problem. And so you said that after the portraits, that you intend to do future portrait projects?
Yeah, if you go to the website, portraitstoryproject.org, there's a mission statement there, and it fits on one page, even though it's pretty densely worded. And the gist of it is, if you see the post-Katrina portraits and you feel that that kind of art and story documentary project could serve your community, what situation you're in its struggle for self-determination, then my email's there, and you can contact me, and another such project could emerge out of that. I work for Bed and Board, and the most desirable situation is for the entity, be it a tribe or a neighborhood, or a nation that's not a state, a community, however it's defined, an intentional community, an unintentional community that becomes strong, to use my media solidarity to support their own empowerment. And they can sell the images as an enterprise, as a fundraiser for their cause, or they can just use it for educational value. They can make it their own exhibit, or they can just keep it within the posterity of their own community. So there's a few different directions a community could take the Portrait Story Project with once they'd made it their own.
Yeah. Wonderful. So I wanted to see, because I have these Ian and Edwin here, did you have any other questions either of you wanted to ask? Ian?
Hi, my name is Ian Mays. I'm here also interviewing. So one question I want to ask is, what obstacles do you see as existing in the way of like building or rebuilding New Orleans in a just, sustainable way?
One guy that I spoke to, his name was Ronald Lewis. He remembered Hurricane Betsy in 1965, and he had really intriguing analysis based on his experience about why the Lower Ninth Ward came back faster after Betsy in 65 as opposed to after Katrina in 2005. There was no FEMA in 1965, he said, and FEMA has been sometimes only giving residents money if they agree not to return. So it's a kind of liberal divide-and-conquer strategy. The government's surplus economy, its reservoir from its taxes, is so vast that it's capable of being near genocidal, internally imperialist, and blatantly totalitarian, and compassionate in a way at the same time. From a corporate point of view, to pay to make people comfortable somewhere else to get them off the land that the corporations want, it's worth it, the nation state, and the corporate ruling class has the collateral to do that.
Okay. And another question then is how best do you see what are the best ways for outside volunteers or activists such as you and I to come and really most effectively make a difference and still be respectful for the locals and the culture and all that?
Right. Well, the first thing you have to do, you have to listen to the people that you have the pretension of bringing solidarity to, because if there isn't that relationship, then you don't have solidarity. It's only in the interest of the survivors or the refugees or the people that need solidarity if they see it as in their interest. And that has to be understood first. You have to be non-missionary. You can't bring in a set of dogma or something programmatic. The first step is to listen, I think, like you've suggested, and then go from there. Aside from really immediate and obvious things like bringing in water or first aid, but once you're after the immediate crisis and once you're talking about rebuilding communities, then you've got to hear from the community that you're helping to rebuild. You've got to take direction from them. And I think while I was volunteering at Common Ground for a lot of the time, we did that pretty well.
How long were you volunteering for Common Ground?
Just 13 months while I was doing the post-Katrina portrait project. I was from September of 2005 until November of 2005, I was unloading trucks, running a distribution center, organizing toiletries for the first aid clinic while the first aid clinic had toiletries there, doing trash collection. Excuse me, and then house gutting, and then I was getting into gardening, neighborhood gardens, folks that were coming back and had the burden of gutting out their houses and figuring out their whole lives. Gardening usually wouldn't be the first priority, but if you did it, then it would be one less thing that they would have to do, and it was part of bringing the city back in a tangible and specific way. And then by January of 2006, I was doing the Portrait Story project full-time.
I do have a question, and you may have already answered this, and I might have missed it, but what is it that inspired you to do the portraits and have them write or for their words to be transcribed on the portrait itself? Where did that influence or that inspiration come from?
Well, I would say it's pretty intuitive. I mean, fine art is a form of specialized division of labor. It requires the accumulation of skill and having a coherent craft. And this was a way to bridge the gap between elitism and inclusion. It was a way for somebody that didn't necessarily have any skills in the realm of fine art to be part of a fine art installation. To write a third-person objective or supposedly objective narrative or commentary or to paraphrase somebody, that's been done. That's what a lot of media does, or to have a question-and-answer format. A lot of media does that as well. And so it didn't make sense to for me at the time to bend over backwards to do the same thing that everyone else was doing when it was, I felt, more empowering for somebody to write directly on it. They were asserting their own history. They were stating their protagonism. They began the narrative where they wanted to, and they ended it, and also chose the length of it, and the selective emphasis was their own. And it's transparently subjective. It's acceptable and desirable to be subjective as long as you're being transparently subjective. The abuse starts coming in when you have the pretension of being objective, but you're not. And that's when one is not being a responsible journalist, and that's what's going on in a lot of the corporate media these days. And, you know, it's not plausible to, in a disaster relief situation, train survivors that are living moment to moment or day to day in objective media. the subjectivity makes it have a human rather than just a professional element, you know. When one reads objective media, the purpose of that is so one presents it professionally, and then the reader will draw their own conclusions from it. In this, the subject of each portrait was already drawing their conclusions, and it was a whole collage of subjectivity, a mosaic of it, a whole landscape of faces. The magnitude of all the drawings, the thousands of them that were on the walls of the disaster relief centers, it was overwhelming. And that was a part of the point. There's the old saying from Marshall McLuhan, the medium is the message. Well, the medium was vast because the event that the media was arising out of was vast. And so therefore it was speaking directly of the event. It was the event, in a sense, what people were writing. It was a collective journal entry.
All right. So just one more thing. I wanted to make sure you got a good solid plug in there for the website and for people buying the book. So tell them, how do people get that?
At independent bookstores in New Orleans, the book is often for sale, and the entire contents of the book can be seen and downloaded at no charge. PostKatrinaPortraits.org or PortraitStoryProject.org. Both names go to the same site, and the mission statement of the Portrait Story Project is there. If you feel that the Portrait Story Project might be relevant for your own community, an art and story documentary project to bring media solidarity, to contribute to your own self-determination.
And can people not in the New Orleans area who want to buy a copy of the book order it through your webpage? Is that available?
I hope that Common Ground Collective picks up selling it as its own fundraiser again, and that remains to be seen.
So for now, no. Okay. And, thank you so much for doing this interview. Thank you to Francisco. Thank you to Ian and Edwin for helping me. And thanks to the listeners.